John Zonars, Music Coordinator. I think the musical philosophy has always been to try to balance established, very famous, and well-known acts like the Rolling Stones with a sort of cutting-edge, not necessarily breaking act, but an act that is sort of avant-garde. The idea of having an avant-garde act is always important, I think, to Lorne. And essentially, no matter who tells you what about the different bookers that were in place and the bookers that are in place now, it's Lorne who books the show. Lorne Michaels. We're at a place, generationally, where you can do Britney Spears, where enough people are baby boomers who have kids, and you can put an 18-year-old host on, and it will hold the viewers and actually increase the audience. I would know enough to book Eminem, but I wouldn't presume to pick the song he would sing. Whereas in 1975, I would have been, "What do you mean you're not doing this or that song?" You know, I think you have to step back and find your role. Alec Baldwin. I asked Lorne once, is there any way the host can very innocently try to influence who the musical guest is? And Lorne just looked at me, very bemused, and said, "What did you have in mind?" And I said, "What about someone who's a great singer of standards? How about Rosemary Clooney?" And I thought Lorne was going to swallow his tongue. And then he explained to me the basic rule that governs the musical guest selection. The cost of bringing the musical guest to do the show is often shared by the record company, because it's very expensive to bring them and the crew and all their technical equipment to New York and NBC. And very often it's an artist who is promoting current product, and since it's a promotional tool, the label shares that cost. John Zonars. When we have a musical act perform, the network has evidence that proves that the ratings drop off. And frankly, it took me a long time to accept that, because in my world, everyone is worried about the music. We only watched the show when we were kids because we thought the musical act was cool. But the network started telling Lorne that the ratings were dropping off during the musical act, and that we should only do one song, and that the song should be after update. And while they may have a point, I can see how Middle America doesn't care about music, they just want to see the cheerleaders do their skit, I think it inherently screws up the rhythm of the show. Considering the gazillions they've earned at the box office, we're talking mythic money, Mike Myers and Eddie Murphy were possibly more revered by the newest breed of not-ready-for-primetime players than were Chevy and Gilda and Dan and John. Of course, a good many flop films have been based on SNL skits or have featured former SNL cast members, but the show is obviously still seen as a springboard into Hollywood, and key cast members have no shortage of scripts submitted by eager producers anxious to cash in. Will Ferrell. I think there's a perception that there's like this instantaneous thing that happens, whether it's movie offers or whatever. But it's all very gradual, and even after being on the show for 5 years, you still feel tenuous about your existence. People go, "What a great stepping stone." But we've all been happy just to have a job. It's like, I mean, initially while you're here, you're just... I mean, there was a part of me that could have quit after the very first time I was on the show. Really. It was like, wow, I did it. I was on an episode of Saturday Night Live. And I almost wanted to keep it pristine. Andy Breckman. You can't deny the show is a launching pad unlike any other that I can think of. It's a farm club. It has an amazing batting average. It's like a shot on the old Tonight Show, which was so prestigious because it led to so many other things.
Molly Shannon. Lorne produced Superstar, my movie about Mary Catherine Gallagher. Those movies are very cheap to make. They're low-budget, cheap comedies. It maybe cost $14 million and it made $30 million in domestic box office. And then it makes a lot in video because we have a lot of kids who watch it over and over and over again and they memorize the lines, little girls and stuff like that. So Superstar was a very profitable little venture for Paramount Pictures. One of those low-budget cheapies. Janine Garofalo, cast member. The general attitude over there is that with the Tina Fey regime and the Steve Higgins regime, things started turning around. I think the prevailing attitude had been that women just aren't quite as funny. Molly Shannon. First of all, there aren't that many slots for girls. There was me, Anna, and Sherry. So the girls that get there are tough girls, you know. Those are strong women, I would say. We all got along well. I think that either way, you just have to sort of take care of yourself. It's not a man-woman thing. They're not going to put something on because it's a girl sketch. They're going to put it on because it's funny. Maybe before that, women had different experiences than I did. But my experience is, they're going to put it on if it's funny. Not because you're a girl. That's just silly. You're just in competition with yourself.
Chris Kattan. When I first got on the read-through table, it was very quiet during my sketch. They didn't really laugh at all. And I thought, God, this is terrible. And then Lorne put the sketch in. It made it in, and it was like the second sketch of the night. So I was really excited, and people were just, you know, a featured player has never had their first sketch on in their first week or whatever. So I was very excited that I had. It was flattering when Lorne said, you know, you're like the new Mike Myers to me. I was like, oh, wow. He meant that in a sense of, you're going to take care of yourself and do your own stuff. And you can see when you watch the old shows that Mike Myers wasn't there throughout other people's sketches. It was more like, here's the Sprockets, and here's Wayne's World, and here's his coffee talk, and that was his stuff. So it's a great way to always be on your toes, and, you know, it's good training to only rely on yourself. Daryl Hammond. I had no idea that people could be so tired and miserable because of so much pressure, and yet still be good and still be funny. Jack Handy, writer. Even today I'll have dreams where it's like late Tuesday night and I don't have an idea for the show, and then Lorne comes into the dream and he's wearing my pants. Daryl Hammond. When I came here, Lorne told me, we don't go on the air because the show's ready. We go on because it's 11:30. Here you're going to be asked to be at your best when you feel your worst. If your horse have the flu, didn't have time to prepare, didn't sleep well last night, feel depressed, too bad. It's 11:30 and it's live, so you've got to change your mental state. Sometimes by the time you go on, you're so tired you don't even remember why you thought something was ever funny in the first place.
Sherry O'Terry. You get in here and you start doubting yourself. Each week you're auditioning for a show you already got. Each week you're proving yourself. You're starting over week to week. It made me very emotional and unstable. When I did Just Shoot Me, Thursday came around and this feeling came over me, this really great peaceful feeling, because I thought, oh my God, no matter what, I'm going to be on the show. I'm not going to get cut. Here's the thing I didn't know about SNL. I knew that you could write, but I didn't know that you pretty much have to write if you want to be in the show. There were shows I got cut out of completely. My dad came up from Nashville when we had Garth Brooks, and I was completely cut out of the show. It was in my third year on the show that I finally stopped being devastated and crying about it. Julia Sweeney said that she had my dressing room, and she told me, God, how I cried in that room. And it's just the way the show works. But there's no show like it. The good part is that you get to be something different every week, and you get to be seen in front of millions of people. And then I thought, what am I going to do after this? What's going to be as exciting as this? I'll feel good about not having the disappointments, though. I've gotten better at that, because I was pretty much known as someone who didn't take it very good.
Chris Kattan. Sherry O'Terry and I had one thing in common back when she was on the show. We were really left to write for ourselves. You know, it was pretty much up to us. We could never really assume some writer would take care of us. There are some performers that could assume that. But Sherry and I are more specific, I think, and we had our stock characters, so it was a little difficult for us, and I guess it was a little rough for Sherry. This place can be very unfair, and I think it was a little unfair to her sometimes. Like, it was up to her every week to come up with something or she's not on the show, which is a real bummer, and that's happened to me a lot. So I'm like, oh, God, I guess I've got to come up with a new character for this week, because I am one of the people that can't assume that a writer will take care of me unless that person takes a chance.
Tina Fey. Certain words chill the audience regardless of context, rape being one of them. There's a piece that Adam McKay wrote for Rachel Dratch to do an update that was so funny to all of us. It was about some guys who had written a book about how rape is natural. It was just part of the caveman mentality that lives within all of us, and it's part of nature. And Rachel did this update feature as herself, talking about how she agreed with the book and how she loved to rape dudes and graphically described these rapes that she had done on men and got into how she was going to rape the two male authors of the book. And Rachel is, you know, pint-sized and adorable. But the audience, even though it was her saying those things, they just could not, did not go with her on that. Sherry O'Terry. I talked to Lorraine Newman about stress. She talked about how are you going to deal with the pressures because there's so much pressure here. And I was a mess my first 3 years. I was very emotional. I cried a lot. And it didn't all just have to do with the show. I felt very lonely for some reason. I went to work and then I went home. I went to work and then I went home. Maybe that was my fault. But I don't want to do much outside of work. I don't know why. I think I don't love New York. I'm from Philadelphia. I'm an East Coast person, and I fit in people-wise here, but I don't know. It's sad here. I feel like I'm always in a building. And I have that bipolar thing, too, and I'm claustrophobic, so I always feel like just closed in. You don't see daylight very much, and my office doesn't have a window. You can get an office with a window, but then you have to share with somebody. It was really difficult. It was very, very emotional. But then Lorraine gave me good advice. She said, you know, Sherry, back then therapy wasn't what it is today. Drugs were taken to deal with the pressure, but we were so young. And you didn't think you were abusing it, and you didn't think you were taking it for the pressure. You were just partying. But when you party to the point you're emaciated, that's not good. They partied hard back then. And then she said, I can't imagine how you deal with the pressure. And I told her I wasn't dealing with it well for 3 years. There was no escape, so I was like crying all the time. I would go to bed in disappointment. So much was so very, very emotional. And then I realized it. I need help with this. And then I started taking drugs. No, I'm kidding. In its earliest days, the show's famous home base was occupied by a more eclectic array. Raquel Welch, Desi Arnaz, O.J. Simpson, Hugh Hefner, Cicely Tyson, Ralph Nader, Norman Lear, Anthony Perkins, and Miskel Spillman, a little old lady who won an Anyone Can Host contest. But still, there are surprises, political and sports figures one might not expect to take their turn in the show's one-of-a-kind spotlight, or at least make a cameo appearance, like Robert De Niro popping up to gripe about the way he was impersonated on the show, or Janet Reno busting through a fake wall to make essentially the same complaint. The best hosts, Steve Martin, Tom Hanks, Christopher Walken, Alec Baldwin, John Goodman, are invited back repeatedly. The worst are, properly enough, dissed and trashed behind their backs once they've gone home. Ellen DeGeneres, host. I can honestly say hosting was probably one of the highlights of my life so far. It was so much fun. I've never even been to the show, so I didn't even understand the speed of it. When you're watching at home, you don't realize they had to get out of that outfit and into another outfit just during the commercial. So as soon as the camera goes off, you're just pulled and people are ripping your clothes off and putting on a different wig and a different outfit. That was another thing to get over, too, because I'm the most modest person in the world. So to have people ripping my clothes off and stepping one leg up while someone's putting a wig on and you're half naked in front of these people, that was a bold move to me. Marcy Klein. In terms of desirable hosts, we, of course, always want to get Tom Cruise. I'm always trying for him. Then there are the ones who the writers want, but I don't know how to explain to them that the network might not understand. Like Harvey Keitel, one of my, I thought, really good bookings. But we had to fight for Harvey. To me, it's important to have funny shows so that people hear that the shows are funny and then you'll get ratings. It's a longer way to getting a rating. But then there are times where you do a Britney Spears because you know it's going to work. And it gets a big rating, and she was really good at it. I show Lorne the list, but it never gets circulated. No one sees it but him. You know, hopefully. I don't want to spend 3 weeks on one person. I want to say, let's make an offer. Cuba Gooding Jr. is a good example of somebody where I went and saw Jerry Maguire, and I came back and I said to Lorne, I know no one knows who this guy is, but I'm telling you, he is going to be a big star from this. Gary Oldman, who would be my dream host personally, was booked, and on a Thursday night before the Monday that he was supposed to come in, something happened, and he had to drop out. I think Tom Hanks came in and really saved us on that one. Gary Sinise was another one. I was so excited. It's always the ones you're like really excited about that drop out. You call in Alec Baldwin, Tom Hanks, John Goodman. John's done it when someone has fallen out. I mean, this is a major thing to ask somebody. Hey, can you show up in 2 days? When they're not prepared. No one has ever dropped out during the week of the show. No, because the minute you get here, it's too much fun. I mean, honest to God, they are treated so well. When Jackie Chan got here, he said, I want to get on the plane and go home. And I went, ha, ha, ha. I said, I promise you on Saturday night at the party, you will be telling me you want to do this again next year. He goes, never. But I was right. Some of them freak out when they get here on Monday. But by Saturday, they all feel like it's one of the most fun things they've ever done. You know that nightmare when you didn't study for the exam or you're naked on stage or something? I knew I was really producing the show when I started having dreams about hosts and musical guests not being there. Sometimes I'll be talking to Lorne and I'll go, how are you not nervous? I absorb. One host in particular was really nervous. I almost threw up during the monologue because I was so nervous for him. Gwyneth Paltrow gets more people coming up to her saying, you were so funny when you hosted Saturday Night Live, than there are saying, you were amazing in Shakespeare in Love and congratulations on your Oscar. People recognize when people are good. Gwyneth Paltrow, host. For someone like me, who's usually relegated to corsets and British accents, it's really fun to get to do something like hosting. It's great fun for me to play a white girl who wants to talk like a ghetto chick. I never get to do stuff like that otherwise. The first time I hosted, I felt incredibly nervous, not only about how it would come off, but if I would make it through the night, because I adrenalize so much in those situations. When I was walking out to do the monologue, I couldn't feel my hands and feet. But the last time I hosted, I wasn't nervous. I really knew what to expect, and I just felt very free and very lucky to have an opportunity to be ridiculous. I've had experiences where I've been under extreme pressure, an award show or something like that, but it's very finite. This whole experience lasts for an hour and a half of live television. When you do a play, there's 300 people sitting there, not millions. My mom hosted once in the 80s. She just told me, it's going to be great. as opposed to kind of chronicling what it was going to be like. She said, make sure you do this kind of accent, that type of stuff, and make sure they stretch you as much as possible and do things that you never get to do ordinarily, because this is such a great chance to do that. In one sketch, I played Sharon Stone and got in all kinds of trouble. She was very offended by it. She kind of talked about it a lot in the press and stuff. I think she was very unhappy with it, and she felt it was mean-spirited. But then she proceeded to go on TV and stuff and say I was disrespecting all the women that came before me and stuff like that. She waged a press campaign against me. I look at it like it's a rite of passage to be lampooned on that show. If people are making fun of you on that show, that means you've made it and you're in the cultural lexicon, and it's flattering. I suppose some people are less game for that sort of thing. Ellen DeGeneres. To be honest, there was a time that I was scared of them, because as you know, everybody is fodder. They'd made fun of me, especially the whole situation when I met Anne Heche. That whole situation was on a lot. I'm way too sensitive, and my feelings got hurt, and it was hard. Now I have perspective on it, and they were right to do so, you know? Cameron Diaz, host. I don't like making fun of other people. I like making fun of myself. I really don't like playing other celebrities and making fun of them. This program is about current events and parodies, which are fun. But I don't want to participate as the person who's doing a parody of a person who's possibly at that moment being humiliated publicly. Gwyneth Paltrow. The nicest thing Lauren ever said to me was after the first time I hosted. There was a sketch at the very end of the show where I was supposed to say, I'm Gwyneth Paltrow, and you may know me from Emma and all this stuff, but what I really like is hardcore porn. And the sketch at Dress was like a minute and 30 seconds, and he came up to me and said, we're unfortunately going to have to cut it out of the live show. I don't want to. I love this thing, but we're going to have to cut it because it's 30 seconds too long. We're over. And I said, I can do it. I'll shave 30 seconds off. And he was like, are you sure? And I said, definitely. And so I did it, and I shaved exactly 30 seconds off, and he came up to me after, and he said, no one has ever been able to do that, except, I think it was Bill Murray or someone else, and no girl, I mean no woman. So I felt very good about myself. Lisa Kudrow, host. When I hosted, I wasn't really looking at it like, wow, I wanted to be part of the cast of this show and I didn't get to do it and now I'm hosting. Yay for me. It didn't feel like that because it's too terrifying to host. It's this speeding train and you feel like there's no choice but to smash into the brick wall. I didn't feel confident enough to impose my own taste on the sketches. I know some people do. And they are pretty firm with Lorne Michaels and the writers about, no, this one's no good, I don't want to do that sketch, and you've got to do that sketch. I didn't feel right about that, because I thought, Lorne Michaels has been doing this for 15 years, and who am I to say that sketch won't work? He thinks it will work. And I deferred a lot. Thursday or Friday, you're feeling, no good can come of this. It's not possible this is going to work out. But on Saturday night, when you're behind that door about to be introduced, you have to gear up, focus, and commit to, it's going to be just great, it's going to be okay. I'd been told a lot of hosts end up in tears before the show starts. I thought, well, at least I'm not crying, it's not that bad, so I'm going to be okay. At Groundlings, I had done a lot of live work. It didn't have that great feeling of you get to own the material when it's live. It's between you and the audience. Unless your mind starts wandering to, when this is over, then I have to run over there and change into something else. That's when you're in trouble, because you can't then be dealing with the task at hand.
Will Ferrell. The worst host was Chevy Chase. He was here the first year that we were here. And then he came back the next year, and that was the kicker the following year. It started right from the Monday pitch. You could just tell something was up. I don't know if he was on something or what, if he took too many back pills that day or something, but he was just kind of going around the room and systematically riffing. First it was on the guys, playfully making fun, until, when he got to one of our female writers, he made some reference like, maybe you can give me a hand job later. And I've never seen Lorne more embarrassed and red. In hindsight, I wish we'd all gotten up and walked out of the room. It was just bad news. I will have to say, Chevy's been nothing but nice to me personally, and I think he thinks I'm funny, so I'm cool with him, but yeah, he's been quote-unquote the roughest host. A little snobbish, and he'd yell at someone down the hallway, scream and yell, and you would look at him and he'd see you were looking at him and he would smile like, I'm just joking. We'd be like, no, I don't think you are. The other kind of classic one, and he wasn't so much abusive, but he was just all over the place, was Tom Arnold. Even Lorne was like, this will be a bad show, this will be a bad week. And sure enough, it was like, oh, this guy is horrible. Once again, though, he wasn't mean. I think you'll find a consensus on the Chevy Chase thing.
Anna Gasteyer. The one miracle is that every host makes it through. I've seen really drunk people make it through. I've seen really stoned people make it through. Everyone makes it through. The system has been around for 27 years now. It's pretty well-oiled and sensitive. It just happens. Of course, you see a lot of true colors. I mean, even the coolest person in the whole world at some point shits their pants because they're so nervous or so elated that they made it through this terrifying thing, and wasn't it fun? I credit Lorne and Marcy and the show for kind of making each host feel like that was really the most special show, because I've seen people who we've unanimously thought stunk up the barn still really experience elation when it was over and, you know, feel so celebratory and excited by their experience, and it's cute. You see it even in people that are very, very hip and cool. It's scary. People act like idiots when they're scared. You know, total idiots. Jerry Seinfeld was fearful, totally fearful. He was very controlling and weird about knowing what sketches had been picked. He was like, what about this idea? He made people mad. But then once he knew what sketches had been picked, he was lovely. It was amazing. So everybody has their shtick. Obviously, we prefer it when there's somebody like that who brings something to the party, over, you know, somebody who's like, well, she's a pretty girl.
Chris Kattan. There are some weeks where the writers are just kind of unmotivated, and it's like, what are we going to write for this person, you know? She's so generic, she's like this person, or he's like this person, and it's like the same thing again. And then there's the obvious ones, like when Jennifer Lopez was here, it's like, oh, well, we've got to hit these jokes and these jokes. And then it turns out she doesn't want to make those jokes, so then how can we do it subliminally? Jimmy Fallon. It's kind of an amazing thing when you're with a writer. You see the joy in the human face, and not because of what they're writing or the job of writing it, but the excitement that they're going to unveil a good reference or a good bit. Kind of like a mad scientist rubbing his hands together and giggling, if this monster works, I'm a genius, and if it fails, it's back to the drawing board. They're excited not about writing it, but about what the audience's reaction will be. It's kind of exciting that way for the writers. Writing itself is tedious. No one ever really enjoys writing until it's done. But you're excited to people read it, excited to think, will they get it? Will they like this line? It's line by line. It's just cool to watch how insane these guys are.
Molly Shannon. Kevin Spacey was really great when he came. He was an amazing host. He's just like a machine. I want to do this. I want to do that. He just creates the whole thing. He just comes in with a plan and he follows it through, and he was, like, masterful. He was amazing to watch. He just came in and had great ideas, and he's funny. Tina Fey. Part of the beauty of the show is that at its longest, it's only a week. Come hell or high water at 1 a.m. on Sunday, it's done. It's like taking the SATs. They will say, put your pencils down at a certain point. It is best when the host trusts us. It's easiest for us when people come in and trust us. When someone comes in and they're really difficult, it kind of brings us all together against them. Marcy Klein. The host drives the show much more than people realize. When I first started working here, I was shocked that the host had anything to do with this show. I think people kind of have the image that the host takes a limo in on Saturday after reading their part. They just don't know. I think the best host that will make a good show is somebody that is confident and trusting enough to let go. When you come here, you need to trust that we're not going to let you go out there and destroy yourself. Lauren and the writers, all of us, really want the hosts to be as good as they can be.
Steve Higgins. Christopher Walken is always a great show. You can't lose, no matter what he does. I love having John Goodman and Alec Baldwin around. Gwyneth Paltrow and Jennifer Aniston were a lot of fun, too. We've had some clunker shows, but they all blend together. I think when the hosts come here, they're on their best behavior. If they're not, they have everything to lose and nothing to gain.
Tina Fey. My advice to anyone that hosts, don't bring your own writers if you want people to love you. That was the one thing I thought that Conan O'Brien was very smart about, because he has a staff of writers downstairs, but he didn't bring anybody. He came up here and put himself in our hands, which was a good move. Sometimes people with a large entourage can be difficult. It's difficult when a host will have like a publicist in their ear telling them what's funny. That always seems like bad news when you go down to talk to the host in their dressing room and you're talking through a publicist. Comedy people are hard sometimes, because they have their own kind of comedy that they do, and they can be very resistant to what they will and won't do. I think they're usually my least favorite. A host who actually writes on the scripts and hands it back to the writer is usually bad news.
James Downey. It was ironic when Jerry Seinfeld came because some of the people he brought used to work here at the show. I can tell you that that approach has a terrible track record. I mean, almost without exception, when they bring writers along, their stuff doesn't get on. We will have the read-through without there being any kind of prejudice against them. It's just that often they write stuff that eats it. Horatio Sanz. Tom Green brought in a few of his own writers and was kind of more preoccupied with his image as a guy who doesn't give a fuck. And the show, I think, suffered. John Stewart, host. It was the first time I'd been asked to host, and I jumped at it immediately. I didn't bring any of my own writers with me. They've got plenty. They're very, very talented people over there who already know their thing, and hopefully I went into it thinking I'd bring a little something to the process and shape it in a way that would give this show a little different flavor than it had the week before. We had a great time doing all that stuff. It's a very collaborative environment. I really had just a mind-blowing good time. I thought the process that they used to hone material was really smart. The way the show came into focus makes complete sense. It's very linear. It's not arbitrary. There's obviously politics associated with any organization, especially one that's been alive for that long. As the host, you obviously are a guest, and it's a different atmosphere. But when you're around someplace for a week, you can pick up what's what, and who's what, and where's what, and that kind of shit.
Sherry O'Terry. It makes me feel good when people say, yours was my favorite cast, especially older people who have been around. That just makes me feel good. But I don't feel competitive at all. Why put that pressure on you of what happened before? Rachel Dratch. Oh my God, I love doing that lover's sketch with Will so much. That comes from when I was in college. There was a professor. My friend had her and kind of got to be friends, and before the break for Christmas, she asked my friend what she was going to do, and she said, I don't know. And the teacher goes, yes, just take it easy. Read a book. Take a bath. Eat a bonbon. Spend time with your lover. So that became, for me and my friend, just this big thing we would say all the time. Lover. Later, Will and I were writing something together, and he's like, what about that lover thing that you said in that other scene? Those are the funniest things, the things you joke around with friends. So then we developed it. We were like, ew, you know, when we write it. I laugh so hard it makes me sick. The first time at read-through, we could not get through it. Just like on the show, we cannot get through it. I try not to laugh too much because I don't like it when I'm watching TV and I see someone breaking up all the time. It becomes sort of cheap. But sometimes you just can't help it. I've never been chastised by Lauren for it, but I don't know what happens while he's watching it. Will just make a face or go like, or something, and it just gets me.
Will Ferrell. I'll catch Lorne just like chuckling to himself, something no one ever gets to see, and I don't know if all the times that you don't see him laugh are just part of a facade he has to wear, like being principal or something. We have these Tuesday night dinners where we will go out with the host. Lorne's a fascinating guy to sit and talk to. The times when Lorne gets frustrated is when the typical thing of, what is all the fruit doing in the background there? Or it will be some suggestion where he's like, I want you to remove something. Okay, we'll cut that. No, 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 but I actually like that. But I thought you said... So he can be very vague at times, and the thing you end up losing from a sketch or a piece is a thing. You'll be like, what did he mean? Dan Aykroyd, cast member. Some of the greatest moments in a comedian's life are when you're dying. Horatio Sands and Will Ferrell told me they sometimes watch shows or material they've done on the show that didn't work, but that they thought was great, and they sit there and laugh at how dead it is, and at how little the audience is reacting. I remember watching Johnny Carson. Carson was funniest when he was dying.
Tina Fey. There are a lot of places every week where you're seeking approval. First, you want your piece to kill in the read-through. Sometimes your piece kills in the read-through, and even though it doesn't end up in the show, you can still hang your pride on that. Then you want it to work in dress, and then you want it to air. If you get some of those things, and not all of them, I always figure, well, I got 2 out of 3. At least you can walk with your head held up somewhat. You want the things that you think are genuinely funny first, and then beyond that you start thinking if something has a topicality, that maybe it wasn't in the best shape at the table, but it's very topical and we can make it work. And then as the meeting goes on, it comes around to who's not in the show. Who in the cast is not being represented in the show? Well, what do we have for them? Is there anything that worked enough for them at the table that we can make it work better by air?
Rick Ludwin, NBC Vice President for Late Night. There have been a couple of times where I had to play Judge Wapner in a dispute between broadcast standards and the writers or performers. There was some line in a David Spade Hollywood Minute, I forget exactly what it was, where broadcast standards said, absolutely unacceptable, and David Spade said, well, I'm doing it. And it went back and forth, a ping-pong thing, and finally, broadcast standards said, if you do it, we're going to drop audio. And he said, well, then drop audio. But I'm doing it. I'm saying the line. And so he did it. He said the line, and broadcast standards dropped the audio. Robert Smigel, who pushes the envelope about as far as you can push it on broadcast television, has had a number of dust-ups. The first time I met Smigel, he and Conan O'Brien were writing partners on Saturday Night Live. Conan denies this, but my recollection is they had written the famous penis sketch for Matthew Broderick, with broadcast standards saying, there's a tonnage issue here. We'll let you say it 3 times, but we won't let you say it 10 times. So there's this odd debate back and forth. We'll give up this penis, but we want to keep that penis. Another week, Smigel did a cartoon about global businesses, GE being one of them, and their connection to Ted Kaczynski, the serial bomber. The notion that global businesses were running the world was basically the theme of the piece. It was a very clever sketch. When I saw it, I immediately passed it on up the line to whoever was in charge, because I wanted everyone to know what was going on. Standards tentatively okayed it, and we put it on and it aired once, but then it got pulled from the repeats, and Smigel, I remember, was all upset about it being taken out of the repeats. I said, "Robert, it got on the air. You were not censored. It got on the first time. It got on once, but never again." Robert Wright. Lorne and I had a couple of issues one time with Smigel on one of his pieces, which I think neither Lorne nor I thought was funny. It was just kind of a GE shot without any point to it. If it had been funnier, there was one done on Jack Welch that was a little funnier that we did run. We didn't stop it. The other one ran, but I think it didn't get repeated. It seemed like it was too pointed without being funny. Robert Smigel, writer. I do raunchy and sometimes nasty stuff, I guess, and I get a lot of attention because Lorne puts my name on the cartoon. But it's embarrassing because there's a million funny people here. I have mixed feelings, because sketch writers in general don't get enough credit. It's a thankless position. You get pretty well paid if you hang out for a while, but there are guys here who are just brilliant that I've worked with, and people don't know who they are. One great thing about my cartoons is that people know I wrote them. It's a great thing right there for people to know what you wrote specifically. On this kind of show, you're just at the end of a long crawl, and sometimes they don't even have time to run the crawl. I mean, a guy writes one play and everybody knows who he is, even if it's a lousy play. But you can write 100 great sketches and still be anonymous. I feel lucky to have found a venue that was interesting where I could get this kind of freedom and a little bit of attention. Tom Davis, writer. Every once in a while I'll show up and be a guest writer on a show if the coffers are getting low out here. Lorne will let me come back and appear on the show and make some money right away. It's not because they need me or that Lorne particularly was going, "Geez, I wish Tom Davis would come back to the business." Although the cast and the writers all tell me that they're glad to see me, and I believe them. Things aren't going well, but I'm a happy guy. I've been separated from my wife for just about 3 years now. She is still my best friend, and I speak to her on a daily basis. My ex-wife's a veterinarian, a really good one, and we have all these animals between us, and they're all getting old now. When she leaves town, I go to her house, and all the animals stay there. When I leave town, she gets my animals. All my parenting instincts have gone into just a couple of cats and dogs. I think I made the right decision not to have kids. I seem to be a bachelor till the results are in now. I don't mind it. I kind of like living up in the woods with a couple dogs and cats, and I can go into the city occasionally. That's my life. I live rather modestly, and that's fine with me. Jack Handy. Lorne has always been very kind about saying there's an open door there, and I think when the show got in trouble with the critics and the ratings about 94, 95, they thought to bring in some of the old guns. And so they brought me in, and I think they brought Robert Smigel back. Lorne and Jim Downey, I think, would encourage me or ask me to come back. Chris Kattan. The character of Mango was actually kind of based on an ex-girlfriend. There was a manipulation to her that was incredibly charming. You could nail it like, "Oh, don't you see? You're doing that thing again where it's the whole come here, go away kind of thing, and it's charming and coy and really, really mean." And the joke was that she was a bad dancer, but for some ungodly reason men just fell for her. It's very much like the Blue Angel thing, too. I don't think I was conscious of it, but it's very Blue Angel, you know? I mean, men aren't turning into chickens, but yeah, there is that Blue Angel quality. It's really a frightening movie, and in the end, the poor guy, I remember him being a chicken. Monica Lewinsky was going to be revealed as Mango's wife on one show, but Cuba Gooding, who was the host, didn't want to do that. On another show, Mango had a crush on Matt Damon, and then Ben Affleck pretended to be Matt Damon so he could get Mango for himself. I know some people do think I'm gay. I've had people ask me if I'm bi more than gay. And I'm okay with it, and I like it, because I'm not gay, so actually for women it means I'm not threatening. It doesn't bother me too much. I think there's femininity, something feminine, in my characters that's easy for me. The way I move my body and my rhythm, it comes out a little gayish,